whether it be an anxiety or a fear, what have you, challenge yourself and go find something that challenges you enough that you've got, you know, a 50-50 chance of failure. Go try to fail at it, because, you know, those might not be failures. You might surprise yourself. And I would venture a guess more often than not, you will. And someone will take notice and you'll get an email or a phone call with more opportunity.
Yo, 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 what is going on, everybody? This is your boy, Lofs. Thank you for tuning in to another Motor Misfit podcast episode. I really appreciate you guys getting on and checking these episodes out. They're really helpful, really beneficial. We had some great guests, and we have some more great, fantastic, excellent guests to come. So today's episode, guys, is that we're talking with Jay Payson with HP Tuners. If you don't know HP Tuners, then definitely go check them out, because they are leading the charge in the tuning world right now with many domestics, many imports. Definitely a great company and a great tuning resource for you and your automotive enthusiast vehicle. So Jay Payson is a great guy to talk to. He's been in the industry for a bunch of years. He has so much insight, so much advice that he is giving us. So definitely stay tuned to his story. Check it out, and let's get started with this interview. Yo, 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 what is up, everybody? This is your boy, Los Carlos with Motor Misfit. Thank you, thank you, thank you so much for tuning into another episode. And today we have another great, fantastic episode. We have Jay Payson from HP Tuners. And if you don't know HP Tuners, they are a world leader in the performance tuning world. So Jay, how's it going? How you doing over there?
Awesome, Carlos, man. Thank you for having me.
Awesome. So guys, Jay is a director of North American and domestic sales at HP Tuners, and he has been in the industry for years. From the start of an early age, repairing vehicles and basically running a repair shop on his own, to then becoming an application engineer and working on some of the most advanced performance tuning technologies. Jay is definitely a person with tons of insight and knowledge. Today, we will go over his journey, and he will provide us with some phenomenal advice. I'll pass it over to Jay and have him share a little bit more about himself.
Man, that's an awesome intro, but why are you making me feel so old?
that wasn't the intent, but I definitely wanted to show how awesome you are, man.
we've been in it for a minute. A lot of people ask me how I got into the business, and you know, if my mom's around, all she says is I was born. And, I guess at 3-4 years old, I started taking stuff apart, probably with a hammer. And some of that I don't lose. We use a big hammer to fix things sometimes.
You know? That's amazing, man. So that's...
Yeah, go ahead.
No. I was just going to say, that's awesome, man. And what I see is that a lot of car guys, they start out like just... You know, I got into it at an early age, taking stuff apart. So tell us a little bit more about that. You were taking stuff apart. And then is that kind of like where your passion for all things automotive came by, or how did that happen?
You know, probably around 8, 9, 10, 11 years old, it was going around the neighborhood and taking the bicycles apart and putting different tires on and different sprockets and handlebars and stuff like that. And, you know, you always wanted to customize things, right? And in your mind, make them better. We probably made everything a whole lot worse at the time, but it gave us some creative outlet. It wasn't until the 80s that I really started working on cars. My first performance car was a 76 Camaro. And
nice.
That was fun. I had an M21 in it and a 4-volt main 350. Put a, you know, and did a lot of the work in my driveway. It was a gravel driveway on my back. The first clutch I ever did was on my back, and it was a actually removing the cast iron Saginaw trans and putting a Muncie in its place.
Oh, wow. That's a lengthy repair, huh?
And it's a heavy transmission.
Yeah.
the other issue was, you know, those ring gears hurt like heck when they slide down your forearm and they cut you up. Those are just scars and battle wounds of, you know, early learning. But that was in high school. Moved up and ended up taking automotive courses. And the only way I got through high school was, you know, either the teachers liked hockey and they helped me with my grades because I played hockey, or they had a car that needed repaired and I fixed their cars.
Oh, wow.
That's how I graduated high school. They gave me good enough grades to get me out of there.
Nice.
But that was back in the day when we actually had automotive. And we had a couple of lifts. And this was Brian McMahon High School in Norwalk, Connecticut. And Bruce Mellion was the instructor. He really helped me in my journey in figuring out what to do. He helped me land my first job. And that job was with Craig Kulskar. Worked with his uncle, Bobby Kulskar. And together they worked at a Sunoco station. And that was my first job in automotive. And it was a two-bay repair shop, you know, old school gas station.
Nice. And were you doing just like oil changes, or you were doing like the big stuff already? Because you already took apart the transmission or took down the transmission on your own car.
Yeah, we did whatever came in the door. You know, we had some accounts that were, like lawn care companies and things like that. So we did some fleet maintenance there. So there was the oil change aspect, but you know, a lot of it was just keeping the local people going with their cars. And we had some funny mistakes as well. I had a wagon at some point. I forget. I think it was probably a Dodge wagon, a 318, if I recall. Swapped the motor. Ooh. And record time, man, did it.
Wow.
Got it ready to fire up, and I'm like, you know, and we didn't get quite that far ready to fire up, but I realized I forgot to bolt the flex plate on.
Ooh.
So I had to pull the engine again, put the flex plate on. But you know, it's making mistakes like that grow you and help you figure out. But, you know, through that, Craig, bought the repair sector from his uncle, and he ended up having to leave for a period of time, and he had carpal tunnel. And guys, if you're out there turning a wrench, you don't bang on stuff with your palms. He had to get double surgery for carpal tunnel on both forearms. So he was out for like 10 months.
Oh, wow.
The opportunity for me was at 17 years old, I was running his repair station. And, you know, I learned a lot.
That's
on the
amazing.
Business side. I learned a lot on the customer service side. It was an amazing experience, and a lot of hours. And, you know, there were a lot of times where it wasn't fun, particularly when you forget to put a flex plate on, you're trying to jam out this engine swap.
That'll do it.
that's where I cut my teeth. And, you know, I learned the same lesson. You know, I'm not a small guy. I'm 6'5". At the time, I was pretty skinny, but those lifts only go up to about 6 foot. So it's pretty uncomfortable. And I realized that my body's not going to last long term. And found school. You know, I never took high school serious. It was always in the automotive shop. But I found a General Motors ASEP program. And that was in 93 I started. And you know, I was lucky to graduate high school with like a 1.8, just enough to play hockey or whatever. Mm-hmm. But I earned a 4.0 because I was interested in what they were teaching. And actually, I went and I did a national competitions for automotive repair through Avica. And then I moved into teaching. Once I had earned my associate's degree, I had started a job as an adjunct faculty for the STG group, I believe it was called. And they did the training for General Motors.
Oh, wow.
And I worked out of Tarrytown, and I worked out of Gateway Community Technical College in North Haven, Connecticut. And got to the point where I was training the teachers on how to train the students for the SET, the specialty electronics program that General Motors had. And, that was particularly interesting. You're 20-something years old, young, early 20s, mm-hmm. and you're teaching these veteran technicians. It's that was a challenge in and of itself. But
yeah, I can imagine. But that's awesome, man.
And it's that level of dedication that really, if you love it, you're going to figure out ways to learn what's necessary, particularly as things change. And, at the time, fuel injection was relatively new.
Yeah.
And we were like, what are we going to, we're going from, the emissions work that I was doing at Colstar Sunoco, was drilling out a freeze plug and adjusting the idle mixture to get the thing to idle properly. And now we're using a laptop to make those changes. And, what are we doing in 10 years? How much electrical are we going to have in terms of the fleet on the road? It's another time of transition, and history's repeating itself. And, I really want to encourage you guys out there that are passionate about it, is stay relevant, stay current, and keep learning. And school is certainly a way, but there's so much information out there, and most of my learning has been on the job. And my transition from school to working at manufacturers was, I accepted a position at Eklund Automotive Test Center.
Oh, wow.
And
Eklund Automotive?
ECHLIN, the blue and orange box at Napa. back in the day, if you were to buy points or distributor cap or something, and you were buying it from Napa, it was probably in Eklund Park.
Oh, okay.
But in Connecticut, they had the Automotive Test Center. So my job was to break shit and help the engineers figure out why it broke and then make it better.
Oh, that's a great job.
That was the most fun job I've ever had. And, I earned a nickname, Grog. And, if we had emotes or whatever the heck they call them, it would have been a smiley face with a hammer.
But love breaking stuff.
That never changes.
Hey, but that's good though. If you don't break it, you don't have the fun in fixing it later. Well, sometimes fixing it isn't fun, but most of the time it is.
Yeah, for sure. You gotta find the weak spot so you can strengthen it.
Exactly.
And that's not just to the vehicle. That's to the people. Yeah. I mean, to myself, and right now, where are we transitioning? And what's the next move? And we've got a lot to explore and figure out in the automotive aftermarket. The change in the administration is going to bring on a bigger push for electric vehicles. So electric vehicles are going to be huge, but we also have a huge responsibility to make sure we're legal and make sure that when we're modifying cars, that we have EOs and, that it's, and it's not going to be a popular opinion, but we need to make sure that we're modifying these cars in a legal way that allows this hobby to be sustainable moving forward. And that's a lot of what I did. At Eklund Automotive Test Center, one of my jobs was an emissions technician, where we had run the FTP 75, which is a federal test procedure for determining whether or not the parts we were producing would pass emissions. And, I did that job for several years, and had a couple of very, very cool projects come through. The most notable was probably Callaway Cars. We worked on their Corvette and Camaro programs. And, you know, the LT1, we had a 383 LT1 in, gosh, 1994, 95, somewhere around there. We were working on that. You know, we were making sure it was emissions compliant, and we worked on some of their twin turbo stuff, the sledgehammer and stuff like that. It was a lot of fun.
That sounds really cool, man. Especially like you said, being able to break it and put it back and make sure that the engineers know how to strengthen whatever needs to be broken, but also make sure that it's legal for the emission.
Yeah, and you know, the really cool part of that job was I was able to see a project, like a powertrain project, from the engine dyno into the chassis, onto a chassis dyno, and actually measuring exhaust out of the tailpipe. And it was, you know, it would be pretty amazing how much calibration work would go into obtaining compliance. You know, Eklund at the time, not only were their OEM replacement parts sold through NAPA and other chain stores, but it was also a company that owned Mr. Gasket and Raybestos and Hurst, Mallory, Excel, Lakewood. You know, the it was really cool seeing the testing and being a part of the testing for SFI for the bell housing. SFI, you know, these tests still need to occur. These jobs still exist. Product validation, engineering validation. And it doesn't necessarily take an engineering degree. My degree is in technology. But I did receive a promotion to an applications engineer. And that was in 1998 when Dana Corporation took over Eklund. They bought Eklund and pulled out of Connecticut, moved me to Michigan. And in Wixom, Michigan, I got to work for Digital Fuel Injection. And what was sold as the Gen 7 box was I was on the development team for. And, you know, part of that was also a lot of tier one contract stuff. So we did some stuff for Roush. We did a lot of stuff for Ford Power Products. Nice. And, you know, it's very possible that if you're in an airplane and you have an airport tug towing you to or from the gate, that may have my ignition calibration in it.
Nice.
It was, you know, we did a lot of cold weather testing up there, and we had a reefer truck that was, a refrigeration truck, and you know, it's 0 degrees outside and we have the AC on to try to get down to minus 30 degrees to test cold start with these, because you know, whether it be a generator set that we were working on, or the airport tug or whatever it was, we needed to make sure it was going to start. Dana was more interested in tier one supplying tier one parts. They were more interested in that than they were the automotive aftermarket. And when I went there, it's like, all right, I get to work on 13 horsepower cars. And learned a tremendous amount from these guys. Wow. But I also learned from Dana Corporation that they weren't interested in automotive aftermarket nearly as much as I was. So in September of 99, I accepted a role in Central Florida at a company called Super Chips.
Oh, nice.
And when I started there, I was one of 12 people. you know, we grew that company 801% in 5 years and 1,000% in 7.
Wow. That's some crazy growth.
Yeah, it was incredible. And we did it all without imploding. the owners decided somewhere around 2001 that we were consuming all of our time on custom tuning, and the custom tuning process was quite painful for everyone involved. You know, we were doing everything on, I guess it was a 3.25 or 3.5 inch floppy. I forget the size even, but you know, those little plastic colored discs that you would plug in. So we would build a file on our PC, put it on one of these disks, and then bring it over to the BBS. And the BBS was effectively a dial-up website. So our customer base that was out in the field that would program the cars would dial into our BBS and download a file that was written specifically for a car that they were tuning.
Wow, and how long would that take? With dial-up?
Yeah, you know, it, AOL times, man.
Yeah.
You got a beeping and screeching, and, you know, literally you had the modem. And, you know, you're talking small files back in the day. These weren't meg files. So, you know, you're talking 256K, 56K, something like that. So the download session was, you know, 30, 40 seconds. Upload session was about the same. So from that perspective, it wasn't bad, but we would make changes to a file and we'd hit the wrong key. And the last 20 minutes that we did changing the file would all be gone because it didn't save properly or something like that. So there were growing pains like that as we improved the tools and changed the code and the software that we wrote for ourselves to make these modifications. But all in all, we found the time to really get a system that worked. And, but what we did find is that the custom market was taking 90% of our time. And, you know, it is a business after all. And it was only producing about 10% of the revenue. So there's got to be a better way, right? And you know, we were, I was head of calibrations and in heavily involved in the engineering side of it there. And we had six people produce 9,000 files in 1 year. And we tuned a lot of vehicles. And we ended up doing all the tuning for Vortec and, you know, Johnny Lightning and Paul's High Performance and all these companies out there that we were doing the tuning for. But that revenue just didn't add up to the time that was spent. We, you know, what really grew the company was the off-the-shelf tuning for the trucks is really what generated the revenue. So, you know, so what we did in 2001 is we started looking for a partner that could offer us better tools to do our job. Because as I mentioned, we could spend 20 minutes, an hour writing a file and hit the wrong key and it would dump the file and that work would be gone. So we ended up finding three individuals, Chris, Jerry, and David, and invested in them, and they became Superchips Custom Tuning. And that was in 2003. Nice. And it was a business partnership that didn't work out for various reasons. The owners of Superchips Custom Tuning and Superchips Inc. Had their differences and went their separate ways, but that company is now known as SCT. That was really an honor to be a part of helping to found that. And it's pretty cool. See him every year. I get to run into Chris Johnson and say hi and have a beer with him or what have you. And still good friends, even though we compete and all, you know, have since then. So
nice. So that's so they stemmed off from Superchips aftermarket, you said?
So Superchips Inc. Invested in the three owners for Superchips Custom Tuning. The partnership didn't work out, and Superchips Custom Tuning was abbreviated to SCT.
SCT. Okay. Perfect. Wow. That's that's cool to see how that started.
Yeah, it was pretty awesome. And you know, you had a prior guest, Johnny Johnson. If you guys haven't heard that video, I promise you, he's a lot more entertaining than I am. Johnny's an incredible person.
Johnny is Johnny. That episode with Johnny was a really good episode, and like Johnny just like reels you in. Not saying that you're not entertaining, Jay, because you are. This is turning out to be a really good episode. But Johnny is also like Johnny has like he reels you in when he tells you the story. You know.
He's awesome, man. He is just he's compelling. He's always got something compelling to say. And
that is
true. Know, I'm not that guy, and it's not that, I'm more of an engineer than I am a people person. Johnny's a people person, and we'll leave it at that. I understand, and I know I can be dry, and public speaking for me was a huge challenge. And, you know, for everyone listening out there, I challenge you for every opportunity that you have for public speaking, say yes. Because even if you embarrass yourself, or even if you're not confident, you're going to build confidence. You're going to get better at it. And it's so important. And, you know, I will never hold a candle to Johnny in terms of personability and how he's perceived versus how I'm perceived in terms of people person. But that's not what it's about. It's about being your best self and putting yourself out there. And the more you put yourself out there, the more opportunities that you're going to have. You know, if I didn't put myself out there early on and, you know, 21, 22 years old, I'm teaching for General Motors, teaching these guys in their 40s and 50s and getting these scowls from these guys that are like, man, you're a young punk. You don't know what the hell you're talking about. If I didn't put myself through that, I wouldn't have been nearly as effective at what I've done in my career. And it's a constant struggle for me, you know, whether it be an anxiety or a fear, or what have you, challenge yourself and go find something that challenges you enough that you've got, you know, a 50-50 chance of failure. Go try to fail at it because, you know, those might not be failures. You might surprise yourself. And I would venture a guess more often than not, you will. And someone will take notice and you'll get an email or a phone call with more opportunity. And,
that's some awesome advice, Jay.
Thank you. Thank you. And I believe it because I've lived it. And, you know, this SCT Superchips partnership didn't work out. And that was something that my buddy David Kane and I, we were both working for Superchips at the time. We spent 2 years writing the business proposals to make that happen, along with Chris Johnson and, Jerry and David, and trying to get something that would work between the two companies. And it was a failure at the end of the day because the two companies didn't end up as partners at the end of the day. But we didn't let that stop us. You know, we still needed a partnership, and that brought me to another leg of my career. And, you know, in 2005, David and I found HP Tuners. And, you know, the goal was if six guys can produce 9,000 files, if we put a tool in the hands of specialists that really know how to tune, and I'm talking about the more power tuning, the five stars, the Lunds, all of these awesome tuners out there, Palm Beach Dyno, these guys that specialize and they really do Ford gas V8 and EcoBoost really, really well.
Yeah.
And they can support that market. And then we do the same for the General Motors side of things. We do the same for the Dodge side of things. And it's not the same group of six people tuning for everyone. It's specialists. What can we do to build kits that become emissions legal, emissions compliant after they're tested and get sold in the marketplace? And that's where we are. That's something that now that's where we are today. I started this in 2001.
Oh, wow.
So there's been a lot of fits and starts and failures along the way. And this was David and I were still at Superchips, David Kane. Mm-hmm. And we were looking to really leverage these specialists that know how to tune to sell more hardware. So we found the owners, Ken, Chris, and Keith of HP Tuners, and we negotiated that Superchips Inc. would be the exclusive worldwide distributor of HP Tuners. And at the time, that was in 2005. In 2004, MSD purchased Superchips. So it was venture capital money at the time, and we had venture capital investors in running the Super Chick show at the time. That was a huge learning experience, but we ended up with another failure effectively in terms of trying to partner with two companies, and the owners didn't see eye to eye. And this was a really telling time for me where I needed to decide, what am I going to do? Am I going to keep going with a company that is kind of not allowing me to make these partnerships work, or am I going to go and work for HP Tuners? And I decided to work for HP Tuners, and that was in 2007. And, you know, we were on an extraordinary growth rate right now. It is confidential information. I can't give specifics to it, but we're just absolutely committed to serving the automotive tuning space and producing the absolute best tools we can so that the shops out there can become the next Super Chips or APR or, you know, Palm Beach Dyno or whatever they want to be, and sell their tunes to the mass market. And the goal is to partner with them so that we are emissions legal and we have kits. So the goal would be to find a year, make, model, range. These are the cold air kits, the exhaust kits, the camshafts, the what have you, that the tuners say offer the best performance. The manufacturers to get together, we develop a tune with a specialist that knows that platform extraordinarily well, mm-hmm. obtain the EO, and then bring that product to market. And wow. That for us is the future of the marketplace for automotive tuning. It's legal. Mm-hmm. It offers long-term viability, and long-term for the next 5 years anyway. Yeah. We have other obstacles that give us some opportunity, and that's the other thing. When you're looking at something that looks extraordinarily difficult and it's an obstacle, mm-hmm. that's an obstacle for everyone, which is an opportunity for you, because you need to climb that, beat it down. That's when you get your hammer out and you beat it down until you figure a way. And if you've got to use your hammer to make footholds to climb up, that's what you do. And, you know, there's a lot of motivational studying, a lot of motivational books that I've read through the process, because it's not easy, but it's been very, very good and a lot of fun along the way.
Nice. No, that's definitely some great insight that you shared with us there, Jay. And I can't wait to see what HPT comes out with in the future. And I know that, you know, you guys are an innovative company. I mean, I knew about HP Tuners back, you know, obviously because of like the actual tuning of my own vehicle. I had a Mustang GT and I had a Lund Racing Tune on it using the HP Tuners. And that's how I heard about HP Tuners, which, and I think I spoke to you about this before, like it made me, at some point, maybe not right there and then, but at some point I went onto the HP Tuners website and I was like, wow, this is actually awesome what you guys are doing and how you keep innovating within the industry.
Thank you very much. And, you know, I'm HP Tuners' first employee.
Awesome.
Right now we're, we crested 50, and with COVID and everything, it's been a heck of an experience. But even through COVID, we've been hiring because there is too much work to do. Mm-hmm. And the HP Tuners story is incredible. It was founded by three individuals that, all they wanted to do was tune their own car. So they figured that one of them could do software, the other can reverse engineer the vehicle ECM, and the other can put together hardware so that they can read and write files. And, they developed the product for their own use and determined, hey, this thing's marketable. and that was in like 2003 or four, that they came to market with the old serial interface. And it was something that, man, I don't think they had a clue what they were starting. It has become an enthusiast's passion built into a company. And sure, there's been a tremendous amount of work, but even more learning. And the team that they have assembled, it's the absolute best team that I've ever worked with. The engineering brain power is absurd. It's gotten to the point where technologically we've added so that we can grow outside of just Ford and Dodge and GM. And while my colleague Jim Ferraro handles the import sales, the work there has been phenomenal. They have a no lift shifting for WRX and launch control, and working on Audi and Volkswagen, and you know, these. I've always been a domestic car guy, so I looked at all these, you know, all these abbreviations of the different engines in the import market, and I get lost. But there's a, it's pretty awesome with the amount of coverage that we're introducing. And we've also really pursued diesel. The L5P Duramax, we were the first ones in, and it's really become a large part of our business. We have customers that have earned EOs, so we are emissions legal. With L5P tuning, we have a shift on the fly is coming for the L5P. And you know, all the things that have worked in the past, we're implementing, even moving into the existing emissions legality, shift on the fly, these special custom operating systems for the performance race cars. It's all still relevant and really, really, the more things change, the more they stay the same, it seems.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you for sharing all of that. Like I knew from the beginning, your insight today was going to be very, very valuable. So that kind of segues us into some final lap questions, as I like to say. We're not ending the interview just yet, but these are kind of like the questions that I like to ask towards the end, and they're kind of fast track questions. So there's three of them. Pretty simple question. What is that one vehicle? Could have been that you owned, could have been that was just in your life at some point, that impacted you the most in your automotive career, automotive enthusiasm?
You know, I to narrow that down to just one, I would say the biggest impact is going to be a 1970 Malibu.
Okay. Those are nice.
And 50, I learned a little bit about carburation and points. I learned a little bit about vehicle weight and gearing and acceleration and getting power to transfer. And ultimately, I learned that there's no displacement for displacement when I put a 454 in it.
Nice.
So I would say that was really the first big project that I had. And it was a 3,200 pound Power Glide car. So it wasn't a great combination, but it was a great learning experience.
Nice. I love those Malibus, how they look, man. And obviously the power that you can get from them when, like you said, when you like just make minor tweaks or even just build up or change out the motor in those, like.
Yeah, it was awesome. And
you know, they're amazing machines. Do you still have that car or is that?
No, unfortunately, it was a victim of a saltwater flood in the mid 90s.
Oh, sorry to hear that, man. What? But I'm glad that it added to your automotive enthusiasm, though, man.
Me too, for sure.
All right. Second question that I have for you is, if you had unlimited funds, and let's just leave it at 3-car garage, you can buy any cars for those 3 spaces. Unlimited funds, and these would be your only 3 cars. What would be in those spaces?
So I have owned a 67 Camaro since 2001.
Oh.
So I would complete that car.
Okay, that's nice.
And next to that, I would have probably my 2015 Mustang that is, I ran an Optima Street car in 2016.
Wow.
But I would convert it to half mile and quarter mile. I'd convert it to straight line because it's 1,024 at the tire without nitrous.
Ooh, and, that's amazing.
Yeah, it's pretty awesome. And the third would be, man, it's tough because do I need a tow rig or do I need an off-road vehicle? because the Camaro is going to be the HPD. You know, I could go and race that at the on the road courses and go autocrossing, and the Mustang for straight line. I'm going to have to say off-road, and you know what? I'm just going to have to keep these vehicles reliable enough to be able to drive to and from without breaking them. And I'm fortunate enough to own these. Well, one of them the bank owns still, but I'm fortunate enough to have these in my possession.
So thank you for that list of cars. So you currently own these 3 cars, but if you had unlimited funds, you wouldn't change anything there?
No. I mean, why? You know, if you're going to build a project car, why wouldn't it be one of your dream cars?
That is true. And all those are your dream cars.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's awesome, Jay. So you currently own all your dream cars. That's really great, man. That's like an accomplishment in itself.
They're not where I want to be at the conclusion of the dream. They've got some, you know, the 67 Camaro is still in pieces in the garage. And I've owned that car since 01. I don't know how many of y'all are out there that have a project car that you've had for a decade that's still in pieces. I feel you. I am guilty of it. That car has stuck with me since 01 in pieces because it is one of my dream cars.
That's nice, man. That's awesome. And hey, it's a project car. That's what that's what project cars are for.
You know, I'm with you. I don't know. And I had that a little bit with the Mustang. We're at 1,000 horsepower, but it takes a lot to maintain a 1,000 horsepower car. You know, and it took a lot to build it. Now, the flip side of that is I had considered selling it. And when it came time to actually talking to someone about, okay, this guy's got money, he's willing to pay. I'm not going to make money on the car because a 1,000 horsepower car is not something you're going to make money on. It goes back to that old adage. How do you make $1 million in racing? You start with 10 million. It's same way with these cars. But I don't want to sell it. And it's because it is one of my dream cars. It's also been a part of my, my past and my accomplishments. And, I'll tell you what, if you guys are interested in road racing and autocross, Optima Street Car, you've got to go. Jimmy Day puts on a tremendous event out there. And, it is absolutely incredible if you're into, road race, autocross, that sort of thing. Okay. And it's relatively inexpensive.
That's Optima Street Car, you said?
Yep. Optima Street Car Challenge.
Oh, okay. Definitely have to check that out.
I ran that in 2016 with that Mustang, and it did absolutely incredible.
That's awesome. So you guys heard it there. Some great value resources right there. Definitely check that out, guys.
Yeah, it's fun.
We kind of got off the traffic just because I had that question for you, but I said off traffic, but I meant off track.
No worries.
Last final lap question that I have for you is, have you ever, well, this isn't the question, but I want to ask you, have you ever played Track Daily Crush?
No.
All right. So Track Daily Crush is basically, I'm going to give you a list of 3 cars And out of those three cars, I want to hear your answers on if these could be the only three cars that you own, which car would be your daily, which car would be your track car, only a track car, and which car would you send to the junkyard or get crushed?
Yeah, I wish I could change crushing to sell. Okay, I'll play.
All right. Hey, that's the game, man. But I'm glad you're willing to play. Thanks, Jay. So it's a bit of a tough decision, but I think I'm gonna go with two that. All right, I think I got my three list cars here. So I'm going to. Because he learned so much with that Malibu, I'm going to put that Malibu in there. I'm going to include your 60. It was a 70s Malibu, right?
Yep, 1970.
Okay, so we got the 1970 Malibu. Wow, there's going to be an all-muscle car track daily crush. Okay. We got the 1970 Malibu. We got your 67 Camaro, and we have your 2015 Mustang.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, track daily crush.
Well, man.
Now, yep. I will say a little caveat is that all of these are fixed, running right, all of that, right? So, you know, we're not going to say your Camaro still in pieces. We're going to say your Camaro, you know, once it's all said and done.
You know, the Ford guys are going to hate me here.
Oh, man, I think I know where you're going.
Well, so, and here, I have a reason why. I'll tell you the reason why after. So, when looking at tough decisions, and this really is a tough decision for me, but it ends up being a whole lot easier if you can eliminate choices. So, I'm going to crush the Mustang.
Oh, wow.
And I am going to track the Camaro, and I'm going to daily the Chevelle.
Wow, that's awesome. Malibu. Yeah, that's
it. It's really not that tough. When I sit down and look at it, I already know what the Mustang drives like. It's already done. And, you know, I don't want to say I have any remorse, but, you know, that feeling of when the conclusion of a project and, yeah, it's a dream car and you just made me crush my dreams. But it's a known entity. And I know that at 1,000 horsepower and 4,100, 4,300 pounds with me in it, it's not a great track car, and it's not a great daily driver because it's got the road race suspension in it. That so it wouldn't true. Do just one of those things well.
Yeah.
So that's the logic, and it's unfortunate because I absolutely love that car. The Chevelle, the Malibu, we're going to daily because it's got more room, and the Camaro, I can make that a hell of a track car.
Nice. I have to. So first off, thank you for playing. And those were great answers. And I kind of knew, you know, I was back and forth between putting the Wrangler in there or the Mustang, because I kind of knew where you were going to go, because at one point you were thinking about selling the Mustang. I was hoping I was wrong, but I it wasn't a surprise to me that you would send the Mustang to get crushed.
Well, you know, I qualified that earlier saying, I wish I could just sell it.
Yeah, exactly. No, but thanks for that, Jay. Those were great answers. Thank you for playing. We're getting down to the final bit of the interview. I know we've been going a little bit long, so I apologize for that. I guess two last questions for you would be, let's start with the first one. What are some things for the future? And you already kind of shared this with us a little bit, but I want to make it a more direct question. What are some things that have you excited about the future? And that could be with HP Tuners, or that could be on a personal level with yourself.
So, you know, there's a lot going on in both. I would say let's approach it from an HP Tuners perspective. Keep an eye out. Check out our social media and keep an eye on our social media on Facebook and Instagram. We have so many new products coming out, and we've got some really, really exciting things that I can't really give any details about right now. But 2021 is going to be an incredible year, not just for HP tuners, but for the tuning industry as a whole. And it's, you know, I wish I could give more detail, maybe in a few months.
Perfect. Well, thank you for that. Thank you for sharing that. I really hope that in the future, so I have a Honda Civic Type R. I know you said, you know, you're not really into the import scene, but I really hope that something comes out for that. I know you guys currently do other Japanese vehicles. So hopefully something comes out for that platform. But I guess we'll see in the future, you know.
Yeah, you know, we would absolutely love to. And a lot of it comes down to technologically, can we? And yeah, where we stand with our development team and where it falls on the priority list. So
yeah,
I wouldn't be surprised if we're looking at it. I'm in sales and my job is to tell people about stuff. So if they're working on something that they don't want people to know, I think they've learned by now they don't tell me.
Well, that's a good rule of thumb.
Yeah, exactly. I would love to see it. You know, the Type R platform's awesome.
Yeah, I love the car, man. I mean, I'll tell you one thing. I had a 2017 Mustang GT. So, you know, you telling me about your 1,200 horsepower Mustang, like, really kind of like, I have seller's remorse on that car just because of how long it took me and how many cars I went through to actually be able to own that car. I guess you could say it was one of my dream cars just because I wanted that V8 power and I wanted to do it with the Mustang, right? But even though I have that seller's remorse because I went from the Mustang to the Type R platform because that was another one of my dream cars from when I was younger and I was only into Hondas, I really love that platform. Like it's an amazing platform, both on the track, obviously not in a straight line, but both on the track and as a daily driver as well, which is what I use it for, you know.
So I've got a question for you.
Mm-hmm.
Track daily or crush? You got your Type R, you've got a old school GT350, and you've got your 17 Mustang.
Wow, that's a tough one, huh? Okay, I'll play. Wow, Jay, you really killed me on that one. Nobody has turned it around on me like that.
That's a tough one for me.
Yeah, that is a tough one.
I figured there's a little bit of a Ford enthusiast in you.
Yeah, no, there definitely is, man.
I had to throw that old school curveball in there.
Part of the reason that I sold my Mustang or traded in my Mustang was because it just wasn't convenient for as a family car, right?
Agreed.
And my kids love going with me to car shows. And It was bad, like fitting them in that back seat. You know, so while I loved it, I think I need to keep that old school car. So unfortunately, although I have the buyer's remorse, the Mustang, the 17 Mustang will have to get crushed because
two
I would
them,
keep
two S550s gone.
Right.
Just like that.
Right. Because I would need to keep my Type R as a daily driver. And then or maybe I would make that the track car. I don't know. That's still up in the air, depending how you can prepare the GT350. But I do know for sure that the S550 is going to have to get crushed.
Two of them in one show, and what a phenomenal car to be.
Yes,
crushed.
And yeah, and that's not taking anything away from that car because that car is just great. It's just. Obviously, if I was a single person with no family, then, you know, it might be a little different. I don't know. But as it stands, that's how it'll be.
I didn't mean to hijack it.
You know what? I appreciate you asking the question because that put me, you know, that made me actually think because I never actually thought about that. But that's awesome, Jay. Thanks for doing that. And thanks for having me play the Track Daily Crush game as well.
It was fun.
All right, Jay. Well, I know that we're nearing the end of it, the finish line. So just wanted to two things. Where can people reach out to you, or what are some resources that they can reach out if they want to know a little bit more about HP Tuners? I know hptuners.com is the website, correct?
It is, hptuners.com. There is an S on the end of Tuners. And, you know, Facebook, Instagram are very active, and they're, we have employees that it's their job to monitor. Mm-hmm. You'll see us on occasion, some of the groups that are vehicle specific, as well as some of the forums. But really, the Facebook and our website are the primary, I would suspect.
Awesome. And on Facebook and Instagram, it's just HP Tuners as well, with the S at the end? Okay.
That's right. And, you know, if anyone's interested in looking for work, we're always looking for some dedicated, enthusiastic employees. We list our job openings up on HP Tuners as well as LinkedIn.
Nice.
So those are some very good places. Myself, you know, I mentioned it prior. I'm more of an engineer than I am anything else, although I am in sales now. That was just because it's a company owned by engineers that are much better engineers than I ever could dream to be. So they accept my shortcomings in terms of you know, being socially acceptable. So I'm out there on Facebook and really not active on Instagram. Who's got time for that? I don't know. But yeah, LinkedIn, Facebook are my primaries, and it's Jay Payson.
All right. Awesome. Thank you, Jay. And lastly, I just want to see if you have any last advice for anybody that wants to follow in your footsteps.
You know, I think at this point, particularly if you're starting out, electric vehicles, you need to be very conscious of what this administration's goals are. We know that there are several states that by 2035, they will not be allowing sales of internal combustion engines into their states. I know California, Massachusetts for certain. I'm not sure if there are others. And a lot of guys are going to be like, oh, EV, this, that, the other. I am willing to bet you two things about electric vehicle. I am willing to bet you it is easier to drive across country with electric vehicle than it is E85.
Mm-hmm.
And I would be willing to bet that the performance is on par.
Yeah.
And I am an internal combustion guy, but you know, we all need to be realistic about, well, like it or not, we need to be realistic about what the future holds. And, you know, 67 Camaro that I've got downstairs at some point in its future life might have an electric powertrain.
Yeah, you never know. And you have to keep evolving with the times. So
absolutely. And that's key. And for the shorter term, let's make sure we're working towards emissions legality on everything we're doing. And, you know, that is something where if you walk into SEMA, that show floor is going to contract greatly if we're not doing things legally. And I know there's a lot of products out there that offer deleting and things like that. And we really need to get away from that. We can make tremendous power through emissions and be legal.
Nice. Yeah, that's definitely great advice. Thanks for that, Jay. And you guys heard it here. So definitely you see how much insight and how many great tips and recommendations Jay is making. So you heard it there. And you know where to reach him at. You know where to check out HP Tuners. Jay, it has been an awesome time talking to you. Thank you so much for being on the show, and I really appreciate it.
I've had a great time. Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks, Jay. Well, you have a good day, all right?
You too, man.